of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
I'm Kelly O'Ramaris in Oakland, California, thinking about a world without money. Both capitalism and socialism are money-based systems. What about a world without money? Why must we pay to live on the planet we're born on? It's a natural question for a woman to ask. Women do most of the world's unpaid labor in and out of the home. And when they work for money, they generally are paid less than men. Today, three women who are thinking about a world with different sets of values, laws, and distribution systems than we currently have. Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange, talked about the gift economy on the radio program Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox by phone from Italy in May 2011. Genevieve's vision of the gift economy is based on the mother-child relationship.
We already have a gift economy in a sense because mothers take care of children unilaterally. That is, they give without an exchange, without expecting something back. And they have to do that because little babies don't know how to exchange. They can receive, but gifts have to go from the mother to the child without an exchange. And our economy instead is based on exchange, that is, giving in order to get back an equivalent. If you give to somebody and then they give to somebody else and they give to somebody else again, there is a sort of chain that's created of relationships. A unilateral gift creates a relationship of mutuality and trust between the giver and the receiver, unless you're in a hierarchical situation, and then gifts can be used for power over. But in an egalitarian situation, the gifts go around and create relationships of community. And I believe that underlying our economy of exchange, there is this maternal gift economy that is basically the way we stay alive, because we do satisfy each other's needs all the time in many different ways, and we receive the satisfaction of our own. Every breath we breathe is free. It's a gift from the universe. And then when we breathe out, we're giving a gift to the trees and the plants. So we're already in a cycle of giving like that. I think we're really gift-giving beings. That's what we do as a basis of our lives. And we have placed on top of it an exchange system where you give only in order to receive, and that makes you ego-oriented, whereas in the gift economy, you're other-oriented. And the gift economy is a mode of distribution. That is, it gets the goods to the needs, while the exchange economy basically does not allow the goods to go to the needs. It requires that people have the money to be able to buy the goods. And so it's a question of making more money. So the whole economy based on the market. It's a patriarchal side to it, too, because it's that desire for more, to be the one at the top, that sort of upward motion, that is the patriarchal way of male hegemony and dominance. Those are the same values that are in capitalism. And of course, people will tell me, well, it's difficult to move from one economy like the market economy to the gift economy. In fact, things are really always going the other way, because when things are commodified, like the water is commodified or seeds are commodified, that is, they stop being gifts and get drawn into the market exchange way of doing things. And so they're lost as gifts for the sustenance of the people. And it is going to be a difficult transition, but I think that we all already have to move towards this unilateral gift-giving way, understanding it more as part of who we are as human beings. And in fact, I think we are homo donans, that means the giving being, and not just homo sapiens, the knowing being, because as children, You have to be able to give and receive before you can even know. Somebody has to give to you. So we have misunderstood who we are as humans, and we think that we are supposed to be exchanging and getting the most that we possibly can. And instead, we're supposed to be living in nature the way that nature functions in giving freely. That's what we're supposed to do. Now, the market economy is actually channeling all the wealth, all the gifts is channeling them to the few people. And so it's creating the scarcity that it makes gift giving difficult. And if it doesn't succeed in creating the scarcity, if too much wealth accumulates in the system, it wastes it. And how does it waste it? On wars, by destroying wealth through armaments and through killing and bombing and creating a disaster where a life could be. And this is also so expensive for the economies at home, like our own economy in the U.S., where the nurturing is not done anymore because all the money is going to nurture war.
How do we reach out from our families to our communities to really, in a practical way, implement this idea of a gift economy?
I think you begin to realize that what you're doing in your family is probably already part of a different economy. That is, women are already, or mothers, and some men, because some men are mothering also, do this unilateral gift giving, which is in contrast with our exchange economy or capitalist economy. And a lot of the times, people that are doing the gift giving are feeling like they're in the wrong because they're not functioning according to the standards of capitalism. But that's really not true. It's another economy that's trying to come up, that's trying to grow. And it's a much more human and humane economy than capitalism, which is really suicidal at this point. There are already lots of attempts at doing gift economies. The internet has a lot of gift economy going on already because knowledge can be shared. We have things like Wikipedia, which is altogether a gift economy project. There are many different initiatives. There's maybe small initiatives, but it shows that people are already trying to do it. People are getting a chance to experience the difference that you feel also yourself when you're doing giving and receiving in the egalitarian situation rather than having to exchange. All of the things like time banks and alternative currencies are all working in that direction, although they still have some calculation and the measurement of what's given and what's received. I met a woman not long ago who said to me, I used to just go to my neighbor's house and take her a cake, and we would sit and chat, and it was fine. We had a very good relationship. But now I'm in this time bank thing, and so I have to calculate how much time I put into baking the cake, and it's not the same relationship anymore.
Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange.
Of course, all of this is experimental, and people have to support themselves in the exchange economy in order to make a community in the gift economy work most of the time. But what I would hope that eventually could happen would be, for example, that a government could put up the money for larger scale economic experiments, like 1,000 people or more, that would be living in different economic ways, according to different values and standards, and experiment them.
But government, more often than not, is a hindrance to this type of economic experimentation. Berkeley attorney Janelle Orsi, co-director of the Sustainable Economies Law Center, is a pioneer in the field of sharing law. In 2010, she made a video called Economy Sandwich. It outlined some of the legal gray areas of new economy experiments.
I used to reassure myself that one day I will have enough money. Someday, somehow, we all think that, right? How can we not hope that? someday, somehow, we will all have enough money, right? Well, not really. At some point, I realized it would be easier to stop looking for more money and look for a new economy instead. I noticed something suspicious about the definition of the word livelihood. It may look like just an innocent noun in our dictionary, but look at what this definition is saying about our lives. We go to work. Our work gives us money. We take it to the store or to our landlord or gas station or wherever, and we buy the things that we need. And so on. It's an endless cycle. Go to work, get money, buy things. Go to work, get money, buy things. And the thing that's a drag is that we work so hard and we spend a lot of money. And both of these activities create wealth, extra wealth. But all the surplus goes to whoever owns the businesses, which is people who may not even live in our community. And we're so busy in this cycle of work, we barely have time to object to the big messes our economy is making of things, like, you know, our planet. Messes that are ultimately going to come back and get dumped on us and our children's generation. So a lot of people have decided to break out of the cycle a little bit and try to get more of what we need without buying stuff. It's the grow your own movement, the do it yourself movement. We make stuff, build stuff, repair, reuse, recycle, grow, cook. It's fun and it's satisfying. And although these kinds of projects can rarely meet all of our needs, it's actually opening the door to putting the lively back in livelihood, because millions of people are beginning to take these activities one step further and to connect with others in our community to share stuff and cooperate, give, exchange, barter, teach, help each other out, buy from each other locally. But when we take it that one step further, we step into some interesting legal gray areas. You see, here I am. I've made some fabulous squash stew, and I've invited my friends over to share it. I could even ask them to bring a side dish. But what if I want to recover my costs and maybe make a little extra money for all my efforts? So I ask everybody to chip in $4. Have I accidentally found myself operating a soup business? Well, what's the difference between asking people to bring a side dish and asking them to bring $4? Well, the law says there's a big difference. And now there will be all these difficult legal hoops to jump through. Don't get me wrong, I appreciate these laws. They keep us from, well, poisoning people and burning things down and exploiting others, etc. But these laws don't apply well to everything we want to do. Many laws and regulations developed over the last century to carefully control the activities of very large businesses. As a result, jumping through these legal hoops can be hard and expensive, and the only people with the financial resources to get through them are, well, you know who. And I think, gosh, I just wanted to share my stew. It's not like I've started a super-sized stew restaurant. I haven't even started a small business, not even a micro-enterprise. At most, you could call it a nano-enterprise. It's almost like I've landed smack dab in between running a business and simply cooking for myself and my friends. But, you know, that in-between place is, ta-da, the new economy. It's sandwiched in between the realm of commercial economic activity and the realm of personal economic activity. And by virtue of being in a sandwich, the new economy falls right into legal gray areas, and it's not always clear how and when laws and regulations apply. Now, here are some other ways the new economy is playing out, and examples of why the legal stuff is so confusing. Take transportation. Lots of people own a car. It's very different from running a car rental business, which is a highly regulated industry. But what if you and 10 neighbors start a car sharing club to share use of 3 cars? Now, are you a car rental business, or are you just a bunch of people who own a few cars? You're in a gray area, or in this case, a green area, sandwiched right in between these other two activities. And how about carpooling? Lots of people do it. Giving someone a ride to work is very different than operating a taxi cab company. But what if you're giving people rides and getting a little money for it? At what point does your carpool arrangement turn into a taxi company? And then there's growing food in your backyard, which is a very different type of operation than having a commercial farm. But what if you just grew tons of vegetables in your backyard and you maybe want to sell them? Are you a farmer or just a gardening fanatic? Or are you sandwiched somewhere in between? And then there's your home. Having a home is nowhere near as complicated as owning and managing a hotel. But what if you start hosting travelers in your home on a regular basis and you get money for it? There are websites that allow you to do this fairly easily. Will the law treat you as a hotel? And grocery shopping. What if a group of friends gets together, buys wholesale food in bulk, and then divvies it up? At what point does this little buying club get treated as a grocery store? Then there are people who are putting solar panels on their roofs, which is nowhere near as hard as starting a wind farm. But what about people who get together and share a wind turbine? Would the law classify them as a public utility? Oh, look, it's me on vacation in the Hawaiian sun, picking fresh fruit from trees all day. Oh, paradise. Oh, look, it's a farm worker in the hot sun, picking fruit from trees all day long. Ugh, gosh, paradise. Yeah, right. And then there are those people who go on vacation to volunteer on an organic farm. It's a lot of fun, it's very educational, great for the farm. But unfortunately, it's usually illegal for the for-profit farms to use volunteer labor. Our laws are designed to prevent exploitation of workers, which is great. But those laws aren't well suited for all the ways that we work and volunteer and do favors for people.
Janelle Orsi's website is sustainableeconomieslawcenter.org. As more and more people throughout the world face the loss of jobs, homes, health care, and environment through current money-based economics, it is clear that the experiments with new ways of distributing goods and services will not stop. What would a world without money look like? Roxanne Meadows and Jacques Fresco of the Venus Project say the answer is a resource-based economy. In May 2011, I interviewed Roxanne via Skype Internet telephony, a rather fitting way to talk with someone who believes we need more science and technology, not more money, to meet our needs.
Money is an interference factor between what you need and what you're able to get. So people could have all their needs met easily, but our social design is very old and doesn't accommodate to the benefits of technology, to what we can have if we used our technology wisely, not to use it for military. We make so much money from military today. We can go directly to use resources to solve our problems. We don't have enough money to solve our problems. We don't have enough money to feed or house the entire population, but we do have enough resources. A resource-based economy uses resources, not money, not barter, not credit, no servitude of any kind. All the Earth's resources become the common heritage of all the Earth's people.
We're running out of resources, peak oil, peak food, whatever. Are we too late for a resource-based economy?
Whenever resources are low in the future, scientists would be working on substitutes for that. They have done that all through history and arrived at new materials and new things and new ways of doing things. But we would be teaching a very different way of using materials in the future. We don't have enough resources to continue as we are doing today. And by that, I mean this system, the monetary system, continuously sells just erroneous things that you don't even need just to keep the market going. To keep our market going, you have to continuously buy things. People have to be continuously making things, whether we need them or not. We are plundering the planet because of the system that we live under. We're polluting ourselves, polluting our air, our water, our food, and they can't afford to care because they have to meet the quotas. They have to make the money to give it to the stockholders. It's not for the well-being of people. That's the difference between a resource-based economy and the monetary system. The monetary system's bottom line is profit for wealth, property, and power. The bottom line for a resource-based economy is the benefit and the well-being of people and the preservation of the environment and the restoration of the environment.
Roxanne then gave an example of the way a resource-based economy works, an example from the mid-20th century.
During World War II, we didn't have enough aircraft to get into war, and we went from very few aircraft to thousands of them. We didn't have the money, but we had the resources because people also gave willingly of their materials and aluminum and sacrificed to build up the aircraft industry so we could go to war. So, you know, we do this in times of war. We all chip in and get together, and even though we don't have the money, we build what we need. That's the same thing in the resource-based economy. We don't need the money. It's not money that people need. It's the resources and access to the necessities of life.
So basically, we act like a resource-based economy when it comes time to go to war. Our need right now is to act like a resource-based economy to fulfill people's needs.
Exactly that. Yep.
Why don't we do that now?
Because there's no money in housing the poor. There's no market with people who don't have the money. They don't care. And I always say they can't afford to care. There's no return in feeding the poor, so they get neglected. They can't make any money off of it unless the government sponsors it. The government does sponsor the industries when we go to war.
So it seems that we really need to get to that point, mass re-education, both in terms of values and in terms of specific subjects. What do you envision a resource-based economy doing in terms of education?
We would want people in the future to be multidisciplinarians, not go into one field, because if you know a lot about a lot of different things, you're generally more creative. So in the future, people would be taught science and technology and the arts. And there would be professions. People would be working on things, but they'd be working on things that are relevant to all people. They'd be working on heart disease or cancer or prefabricated houses that go up quickly and efficiently and conserve resources. And they'd be taught different systems and architecture. Architecture today is really monuments to people's ego. They don't think of an entire city system approach. Building a city from the ground up that's efficient and clean, transportation is clean, and renewable energy. You know, it's a very different way of thinking of building within a resource-based economy. So education would teach all those things. You can look at the designs on our website under the city systems, under technology, and you can get an idea of what a total city system would look like, how we relate to one another, how we relate to the environment. We look at the cities as university cities. Education would be ongoing, where people can always continue to learn and participate in things. It's not like you go through certain grades and you're finished and you get a diploma. You're always learning. You never die from learning.
But what happens when Mother Nature steps in to remove resources? How would a resource-based economy deal with an emergency such as the Sendai earthquake and tsunami where all the resources were destroyed?
That's a good question. We would have warehouses. We have natural refrigeration still in the North and South Pole. We can use that to freeze food. Then a group of people called the Special Contingency Group has the ability to go all over the world. The Special Contingency Group don't have to report to anybody, don't have to get permission from anybody. They have access to the goods and services, to housing that goes up very quickly, to wafers, extruded foods for emergency foods that have all the vitamins and the nutrients in them, and they're wrapped in wrappers that disintegrate, that don't destroy the environment, or you can eat them, the wrappers. Our technology is racing forward, and it can solve the problems that we have if we use it directly towards ending social problems that we have, and not for the benefit of wealth, property, and power as it is used today. So you have a group of people that can meet the needs of anything like earthquakes, hurricanes, tsunamis, and they're trained ahead of time, and they have all the resources they need to go in and clean up the area and house and feed and clothe people.
Do you see any particular benefit to women of a resource-based economy?
Tremendous benefits for women, but not just women, but for everyone. Today, women obviously have a lesser role all over the world, and it's because they're not able to get the jobs with the same type of purchasing power as men, even though they're doing the same jobs quite often. Or in some societies, they can't have any jobs at all or even drive. In the resource-based economy, You don't have to fight for human rights. You don't have to fight for women's rights. Because what you're really fighting for is access to resources. And people don't realize that. But they're fighting for jobs so they can get money to get resources or a say in certain things. In the resource-based economy, you don't depend on your husband for your well-being. You aren't trapped in a marriage that is detrimental to you and your kids because you can't put food on the table or you can't get shelter for your children. So women will have the freedom to do anything that they want and won't be restricted because of money.
The Venus Project website mentions generating a new incentive system based on human and environmental concern. What would be the forms of non-monetary incentives in a resource-based economy?
Well, primarily no war, no hunger, no crime, people contributing and getting along well. They tell you today, and don't buy into that, that the incentive today is money. Well, what's the incentive of Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and for those who are religious, Jesus? Martin Luther King didn't walk down the streets of Alabama to get his head bashed in because somebody gave him $1 million in his bank account. No, he did it because he believed in the direction. And I think people work really, really hard when they believe in something. So the incentive is a better way of life, and always seeing your environment improving and your standard of living improving. If that's not enough incentive, I don't know what is.
Roxanne Meadows' website is thevenusproject.com. Special thanks to Cindy Sheehan and Janelle Orsi for permission to use their audio. All of the women in today's program have free material on their websites for anyone interested in the question, why must we pay to live on the planet we're born on? Cindy Sheehan's website is cindysheehansoapbox.org. Janelle Orsi's website is sustainableeconomieslawcenter.org. Genevieve Vaughn's website is gift-economy.com, and my website is endmoney.info. I'm Kelly O'Ramaris in Oakland, California, for Wings.
For just one day, I want to forget the value of money and gold. I want to live life my way and lose my inhibition threshold. For just one day, I want to feel totally free. No responsibilities, just everything is okay. No desires, just surviving is the key. Surviving is the key. Surviving is the key. Surviving is the key.